on Mars. Domestic violence is an age-old issue, but it has taken repeatedly deadly turns in our area recently. In several cases, it has gone beyond the bruising and battering most often associated with domestic violence. We'll talk about the problem with Maggie Menefee, Executive Director at ALIVE, Alternatives to Living in Violent Environments. It provides counseling, emergency sanctuary, and other critical services to victims of domestic violence. Kristen Bulin is Clinical Site Supervisor for Provident, Inc. It provides mental health services to vulnerable individuals and families. And Sylvia Jackson is Executive Director of Women's Safe House, a shelter for women who have been abused. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Maggie, let me just start with you. Is there a number out there with regard to the number of incidents in our area of domestic violence and abuse?
I can tell you the number of reported incidents from law enforcement. In 2016, there were over 9,000 reported incidents. Now, those were the ones that were reported in the counties that we serve, which would be St. Charles, St. Louis City, St. Louis County, Jefferson County, and Franklin County. And it's pretty consistent with the year before. There were about 9,500 in 2015 and about that number reported in 2016.
The key word, I think, in what you've just said is reported.
Exactly, because we also know from federal statistics and from our own state statistics that about 40% of women do not report it to the police. And that would be consistent with the individuals that are calling our crisis line.
Why do they not report?
Fear. Fear of repercussions from the abuser. They're maybe had a bad experience in the past when they did report. So those are a couple of reasons that an individual may not go ahead and report.
Yeah. Sylvia, domestic violence is really many things, isn't it? It's not just a man beating up a woman, or we should point out a woman beating up a man. That happens as well.
Right. Yeah, Don, you make a really, really good point. Yeah. You know, most of the violence that we deal with is really intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. And for the Women's Safe House, that is violence perpetrated against women by men. But women do better, you know. And so we, at the house, last year we turned away roughly 1,100 women and children because the shelter was full. Now, we served about 457 women and kids. But the rub is turning away the other 1,100 because there's no room at the inn.
So they go back, I suppose, then to the situation that brought them to you in the first place.
Most times they do. Sometimes they'll go into general shelter, which does not offer the safety factors and safety features that are available in a safe house.
One of the things I wanted to get to is we mentioned battering, but it is other things, too. There's other forms of abuse.
There are so many forms of abuse. You know, most of the time it's emotional and psychological abuse. In addition to that, there's also sexual and financial abuse. You know, most women don't leave because of the kids or because of finances. I mean, I think that Maggie can agree that most women stay in the environment because of the dependence that they have on the financial factors.
Right. And Kristen, let me turn to you. It seems to me that psychological abuse, while maybe not as bad as being beaten up, is still pretty bad.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I think it's huge. And it's an invisible conundrum. It is a painful problem for the victims. And those who come into Provident as we're working with these batterers, that is the main focal point in working with those belief systems. Because with that language, with that verbal abuse, that psychological abuse, it just beats down the victim. And that is what the batterer's intent is doing, to control these individuals. And that is a belief that stems from the roots of their core.
I'm sure we're all at this table aware of the recent spate of deadly violence that has been taking place.
Definitely.
And there really has been an uptick in that. Do any of you have any sense of why now? Is this just an anomaly or what? Maggie, do you know?
In terms of why now, I think I don't think we have seen an increase when you look at the statistics from year to year again for the number of homicides that are reported and related to domestic violence. But these are the headlines that make the news. But every day, you know, we are getting calls from an individual who might have been choked to unconsciousness, or they may have been physically abused. So those are the things that don't make the headlines. Mm-hmm. I think this is the thing that, you know, I don't want to say that there's an increase as much as it is a fact. It is, it's the possibility exists. The access to a gun certainly makes it an increased risk factor. And those are the things that we have to pay attention to, and what can we do in terms of prevention. One of the things I also want to speak to when Sylvia talked about turning away individuals from their shelter, because that is one of the pivotal pieces that Alive provides, because when the shelters are full, they are told or they're given our information to call us, because we can put somebody into an undisclosed motel. And that allows them to be safe until we can get them into permanent placement, into a shelter. Mm-hmm. So those 1,100 still might have an opportunity to have safety through our services, and that makes a significant difference.
Yeah, that's true, Don. I tell you, I agree completely with Maggie. I mean, our community has what I believe is probably one of the strongest commitment among agencies to provide support for women, kids, and even men. That are victims of domestic violence here in the St. Louis region.
Which we can take, that's one of the other areas that we are capable of doing. Because we don't have the traditional shelter, we can provide services to anyone who is a victim. Mm-hmm. So we can provide services to a male victim, transgender, LGBTQ population, which is much more problematic for the traditional shelter.
By the way, we'll put information, website information from all of your organizations on ours, so people can go
Thanks.
To stlpublicradio.org and find you. And hopefully people will, if they don't know about you, will after this program. Kristen, is there a profile of a victim? Is it is there a certain type of woman or man that is victimized?
Well, I don't believe so. I mean, I'd like to hear from you all as well. We tend to, take a look at all the individuals coming in who are perpetrators and have not noticed or have not seen any type of characteristic of the victims. So when we're working with the perpetrators, working with those abusers, they are really accentuating, and we're trying to accentuate what their activity was, what their event was, how they thought about it. And really, the characteristic of the victim is pretty much across the board.
What about the abuser then? Is there a profile there?
You know, we go to traditional points of view and research and have noticed it's not an anger management issue. It's not someone who is just angry and triggered by environmental or something of their belief that is socialistic. It is more about them having ownership and power over their spouse, partner.
Control.
Yeah.
It's control.
It is
the
control. And so that is unseen. And it can come out in a very obsessive jealousy type way. Mm-hmm. It can be very manipulative. The cases you pointed that were able to reach the media and unfortunately have become quite a series of events, unfortunate events that these have occurred. These individuals, these batters, these perpetrators are just are horrifically obsessive, controlling, constant jealousy. The idea of owning their partner is really, and I mention this again, to the core, to their real true belief. And that is an incredibly hard thing to fathom as we read these stories in the newspaper, on the radio.
Yeah. I tell you one thing, the societal norms that allow domestic violence and sexual assault to occur are also part of the really big problem. You know, being able to, dispel some of the myths around domestic violence. You know, women aren't property. You know, kids aren't property. You know, and sometimes, you know, true to what has been said earlier, people think that they own or can control, you know, that that's their property. Men will show up at the shelter saying, hey, I'm looking for mine, you know, as if these people actually belong to him or her. You know, so I think dispelling some of the societal norms that allow domestic violence to exist in our society is also what our work is about.
That's pretty much a constant, what you've just said about the way men react to this whole situation.
Pretty much.
Yes.
Maggie, let me ask you, I know this is part of the picture, and that is that certain assumptions, speaking of myths, certain assumptions are made about who the batterers are and who the victims are. And yet both categories cross all demographic lines, don't they?
Absolutely. All socioeconomic, all race, religion, it doesn't really matter. Anyone can be the victim of domestic abuse. You had the incident in Ladue. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You had the incident in Glasgow Village. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Both of them were in positions where someone was in control of the other. Someone felt helpless and vulnerable and didn't know what to do to be able to protect themselves.
Right. I have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our conversation on domestic violence. My guests in studio are Maggie Menefee, Executive Director at Alternatives to Living in Violent Environments. That's ALIVE is the acronym. Kristen Buellen is Clinical State Site Supervisor for Provident, Inc. Sylvia Jackson is Executive Director of Women's Safe House. Back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you would prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Maggie Menefee, Kristen Buellen, and Sylvia Jackson. Maggie, let me come back to you. Do restraining orders and orders of protection, are they successful generally?
They can be.
Yeah.
Because
you imply that maybe they're not.
I'm just saying they can be successful. Yeah. And we do encourage, are we at least educate someone when they call our crisis line, we're going to give them information and provide them knowledge about how they can access an order protection and then lead into a full order, which gives more sufficient grounds. If it is violated, it can move into a felony, which is more accountability for the perpetrator and more protection for the victim.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia, what can a person who is being abused do? What is the first step? Is it just to get out of the house? Is it to make that phone call?
You know what? It depends on what's happening at the time. What we like to believe in is primary prevention, you know, that the best thing for her to do is to get to a safe space, you know, get out of the immediate line of fire, you know, get somewhere safe, call somebody, a safe house. You know, part of our crisis hotline is to advise women on how to make a safety plan. You know, and a safety plan for me might look differently than a safety plan for Maggie. You know, my safety plan may look something like having an extra set of car keys outside of the house, you know, so that if I have to run outside the house, I can get those keys and get into the car. You know, a safety plan for Maggie might look totally different. You know, she might need to have all of her Social Security cards and all of her kids' information at her mom's house, you know, because she can get there. So one of the things that we do at the Women's Safe House is make sure that each one of the people who call our hotline gets a personal safety plan. That primary prevention, that's the key.
Kristen, why do so many women go back into this environment?
I think for multiple reasons, but one of the main reasons is fear. Fear of not only what will happen to them and their children in light of the batter, in light of the perpetrator, in their safety, but also the economic. They're so damaged. They're so put down. They're so broken. They're needing to know that they will be in a place that will take care of them. And that is what they know. And that is a very hard place to be where you have to break that belief system. I keep going back to that, really changing that and shifting it for them.
They're dependent on
They're dependent on that. Yeah.
Some women, you know, actually go back for the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at women in shelter all the time, and she may be ready to make that change. She may be ready to heal. But the kids are saying, hey, look, I miss my stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is not that bad. You know, and shelter isn't for everyone. Coming into shelter and living communally doesn't work for everyone. And that's exactly what you're going to do when you come into domestic violence shelter.
How long is a typical stay at a shelter?
6 to 10 weeks.
Oh, that's
a long time.
That is a long time.
It
is.
Yeah.
Sylvia, you had mentioned a moment ago about making that call and getting on it. We have a caller to the program. Tom joins us from Jonesburg, Missouri, with an issue dealing with phones. Let's take his call. Okay. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I'd like to ask your panelists, because I've done this in the past, is collect used phones. I was working at a business, and I collected a whole box of them and donated them to a woman's shelter like this for use for their residents. And I wanted to find out if that's something you still are looking for, is cell phones, and if so, to give a shout-out to all your listeners that they could use those.
Maggie?
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom. We do accept those as a donation. If you contact our agency, and Don has referenced it, will be on the website for that information, then there'll be information you can call, and we will even send you out a label to you for you to mail those to us.
That's a good plan. No, a number of the service providers used to have a provision whereby when you upgrade your phone, you could just leave the old one there and it would be so donated. Is that still going on?
And they are sent off and they are cleaned. And, you know, the shelters take them as well. But but they come back and are recycled and used, and we give them away to victims.
Great. Let's take another call. Mike will join us from University City. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so there were a couple things mentioned at the beginning of the show as reasons why people would stay in it. And there were a couple that I thought of that were missed, for example. And you've kind of touched on them already, but, for example, financial dependency. And if a woman hasn't worked or is home with small kids and things, that, you know, is a big issue. The other one is children in schools and, you know, the abrupting or interrupting the kids' schooling or them still going to school if it's a danger once, you know, they've left that home. The other, I used to have a list of indicators. I think it was 12 indicators that basically, you know, would kind of give you an idea if you talk to the abused person that would indicate to them that these are definite signs that it is domestic abuse. A lot of people want to be in denial. Oh, no, he just hit me, and I was at fault, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, if you could address those, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Who'd like to pick up on that?
Well, I think we can start. You know, I appreciate the caller bringing this up because the points are so critical in what does power and control mean to the victim, and what type of power and control is she or he getting from the abuser. There's a lot of different ways that that happens, and using coercion and threatening is an invisible, again, a verbal way of putting fear and controlling the partner. Intimidation, you know, abusing the children or abusing the pets, displaying weapons around the house, that's a form of intimidation. You know, using emotional abuse, constantly putting you down, putting the partner down, playing mind games, humiliating their partner, isolating them, not allowing them to go back to school, get a job, maybe only having a part-time job. Mm-hmm. The financial ability, being able to, when she gets her paycheck, it goes right to him, right to her, whoever the partner who is abusing is. Multiple different ways of doing that.
Well, you mentioned before the jealousy And in an early relationship, having somebody feel, you know, expose or say be jealous of you feels good. Mm-hmm. But what that jealousy becomes is that possession, mm-hmm. and then that leads into the isolation and keeping you away from your friends and then isolating you from family. So you know, that initial feeling of jealousy is like, oh, they really care.
Sylvia, what should I do if I think that a friend or a relative is being abused?
Well, you know what, Don? The first thing you should do is believe her, mm-hmm. or believe him. That's the very first thing. Believe that person, because that person is living in that environment, and he or she knows. That's the first thing that you can do. The next thing that you can do is arm yourself with the right information. As we all indicated earlier, we've got a strong system of domestic violence providers and support right here in the St. Louis region. You know, find out what's out there, you know, call these numbers and ask for help.
But we clearly don't have enough. I mean, you've all indicated.
Well,
we
don't have enough.
I think, and again, with, you know, with Sylvia, you know, saying people can call our hotline number and just say, I'm a friend of somebody. And, you know, the number one thing, you know, believing and listening to that person and being
Absolutely.
Non-judgmental.
You're dying to give the number, I know. Go ahead and give it. But again, most people won't be able to write it. Give it and we'll definitely have it on our line.
I'm sorry, 314-993-2777 is our 24-hour crisis line number.
Again, that'll be on our website.
So okay.
We have a Twitter question, a question here from Britta, who writes, in our current political environment, is it safe for undocumented victims to seek help for domestic violence? That's a toughie.
No,
it is a toughie.
This is a real tough issue.
That's tough.
I know.
Right.
Because there's already a fear factor.
Sure.
Culturally, there's mm-hmm. also the compounded issues around the cultural issues. We do assist if somebody reaches out to us with applying for the U visa. The time frame mm-hmm. on that is possibly 5 years. So there are a lot of barriers for an individual.
Would you turn them in if you found out you had an undocumented victim?
No.
Absolutely not.
Nope.
No.
I think it's important for folks in that category
not.
To realize. I'm going to take one more call because I think Karen is going to touch on a very important point. Karen, go ahead. Make your question or comment quick, though, if you would.
Sure. I'll be as quick as I can. I am a domestic violence survivor, and there were two reasons that were a barrier for my leaving that I didn't hear mentioned. I might have missed it. First of all, there was the unspoken threat that I would be killed. And that is a huge, huge, huge mm-hmm. issue for women. And just because you've left doesn't mean that that can never happen. It's still a worry in the back mm-hmm. of my mind. Secondly, he threatened suicide. I was afraid he would kill himself. Thirdly, I was afraid that if I left and he got joint custody, I would not be there to mm-hmm. protect the children. The children are often used as hostages in this situation. And even if the woman gets out, the children don't necessarily mm-hmm. get out. For the mm-hmm. longest time, What led me to find my finally leaving was that I realized that even present, I could no longer protect the children. And so I went to court to protect the children. But all of those things are terrible, terrible catch-22s for women to be in. You can be a strong, articulate, educated woman. And I think, you know, domestic violence survivors are across the board.
Sure.
There isn't a characteristic. What's a characteristic is that your husband has chosen to mm-hmm. abuse you.
Karen, right, thank Karen. Thank you so much for the call.
True.
Is Karen typical?
Yeah.
Karen fairly typical?
Very much so, yes.
And what we know statistically is, and again, just the fact that a woman is highest at risk for homicide
when she leaves.
And so, Karen, first of all, if you're still there, I'm very sorry for what happened to you. I'm glad that you're safe now. But you are correct. They are giving you those kind. The abuser is making those kind of threats. They're holding a gun to their head. Mm-hmm. In the article in the paper, mm-hmm. the survivor that talked about her situation, she had also had a gun held to her head mm-hmm. and said, "I love you so much, I could kill you." Mm-hmm. So those are very real threats.
I'd seen somewhere along the line that women who a surprisingly large percentage of women who do leave are murdered.
That's true. That's when they're vulnerable.
Most vulnerable. A final thought. We have to say goodbye, but let me go across the line here. Do you want to leave a final thought, Maggie, with our audience?
Again, if someone that you know is experiencing domestic violence, or if you feel that you are in a situation, do a phone call. Call a crisis line, whether it is Alive or whether it is a shelter service. Call and at least talk to someone about what you can do in terms of safety planning, in terms of getting help.
All right.
I would ask your audience to just believe her. Believe her if she tells you that this is going on in her life, or he tells you that this is going on in his life, and then educate yourself. I would also comment that kids witness domestic violence at a rate that's just astronomical. I mean, it's unbelievable how many kids witness domestic violence, even from these recent crimes. One family over in Illinois, there were 7 children who've probably witnessed domestic violence most of their lives.
And sometimes these children grow up to be abusers.
To be perpetrators or victims.
Right, right. Kristen, final thought?
Well, I also want to mention, you know, we have and are doing with the victim services such hard work, and Provident is known to really take on some really tough populations and difficult issues in the community. These individual batterers, I would say from what we have found last year with our work, over 68% have been able to change their beliefs and then have been able to go back into the community through the oversight of probation and parole, and we work very closely with them, that they are able to renew a new way of being in a relationship. And I think that's critical.
And it's also encouraging to hear that can happen. Going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank you all for being with us. Maggie Menefee, Executive Director of Alternatives to Living in Violent Environments. Sylvia Jackson, Executive Director of Women's Safe House. And Kristen Bulin, Clinical Site Supervisor for Provident, for this update on domestic violence. Thank you all. It's an important subject. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.